Roland Luke, businessman and social entrepreneur, teaches from Psalm 1 at the 2013 London and South East Day Conference. Focusing on success and failure, calling, venture and risk, he draws on his own and others' experiences.
Good morning. Lovely to be with you. I'm glad I actually did arrive. Thought for a while I wasn't going to with the London trains as they are today. I'm very excited to be able to speak to you about this topic, and thank you for the opportunity very much, Julian, and to those of you who've come, thank you. I say I'm very excited to talk about it because I honestly believe that aside from coming to know Christ, understanding this thing of success and failure in my book is perhaps the most important next thing to do. Now that may surprise you, but as we go along, perhaps you will see why I say that. I don't count myself as an expert on success, nor failure actually, but I learned some things about success when I was promoted to director of the company I was working with. I was only in my very early 30s at the time, and promoted to the board of the company as the youngest ever director. And it was a wonderful experience, but when all the hoo-ha died down, it was a couple of months later that I found myself sitting in my new office, you know, big oak desk, curtains on the walls, pictures, secretary outside, the whole trip. And I was working quietly by myself, and suddenly I was overwhelmed by a sense of emptiness. And it was as though a voice spoke to me. I know now that God was really speaking to me. If a voice had actually spoken, it wouldn't have been stronger. And it said, "And now, what's this for?" And at that moment, I knew that there had to be more than this. I'd really chased after this. It had cost me a lot of my energy and time, and I'd neglected things that I shouldn't have. My family was one that got a little shortchanged. But I learnt then that this was not the whole deal. And it began a very long journey that led me ultimately to learn things that I will share with you today. And much of what I want to share with you is wrapped up in Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does shall prosper. Success. Now, before we get into that passage of Scripture, I think it's a good idea to step aside and think about what success is not. Because that's the first thing I learned that day at my desk. What success is not. And I want to share just a few things before we start getting into the Scripture about what success is not. And in the first instance, success is not purely cerebral. Now, you think I can't spell, but I needed an S. and I figured that if I did that, you would remember this. So I'm going to give you three PSs. It's not purely cerebral. You know, the psychologists will tell you that, and this is in lots of books, perhaps not quite in this form, that success is a habit. You start with an action, and if you get a successful result, then that gives you positive feedback. So you develop a positive image, which then leads you to believe that you can see it again. And so that leaves you eager to try. It means that next time you try, it's wholeheartedly, not half-heartedly. And that again leads to success. So of course, the whole thing reinforces itself. And you end up with a successful pattern in your mind. It's a rearrangement, they say, of your brain. Now, I know I'm in a medical circle here, so I'm not going to go further than that. And they say that the failure cycle is also a learned habit. So it's the reverse. You get negative feedback, a negative image. That makes you doubt that you can succeed next time, so you're a bit hesitant when you try, which means that you don't really give it everything because you're nervous. So that you tend to fail again, and of course that reinforces the negative feedback, the negative image. It leads to further doubt, further hesitation, more half-hearted action, and lo and behold, you have a failure pattern, and it's set up in your brain. Now, there's a lot of truth in this stuff, but they say that if you want to change this, if you wanted to turn that into a success cycle, then you've got to intervene at the point where you get the feedback. You've got to somehow make a positive out of that. Now, that's what all the sports psychologists are about. You know, every sports team these days and internationally, they have a psychologist traveling with them. So there's quite a lot of truth in this stuff. And it applies in all sorts of fields. So you can set up a success cycle if you can change the feedback. Okay? But I want to say to you that there is a problem with this. It's got limitations, and we know that instinctively. Why? Because much of this sort of thing is what's repetitive. It's good to have a very positive approach to life, of course, but there are lots of the most important things that we tackle where you actually can't be in control. There are very often the most important things you're doing for the first time. So you don't have the opportunity to repeat and repeat and build up the right sort of cycle. And then just because you're doing things for the first time, you're likely to hit snags. That's what happened to me on the way here this morning. I've never done this before, and the roads were blocked, the trains weren't running, and there are all kinds of things when you do something for the first time that you can't control, including some bad things. So you can have the most positive attitude in the world, but when you tackle something big, especially when it's new, you can come a cropper and you've got no control over it. So we know instinctively it's not just in your head. It's not just cerebral. There's more to it than that. So it's not just purely cerebral. It's also not particularly simple. I think it's quite complex, actually. And I'd like to tell you a story. There are two things I say about it being not simple. The first I would like to illustrate with a story that I came across in a book called Green Beach. It's quite well known. In 1942, Britain was in a bad way because, of course, Hitler's armies were waiting to invade, and the morale of the British people was very, very low. But even though that was the case, the war cabinet was busy planning for a reinvasion of Europe, building equipment in places where the Germans wouldn't bomb so easily and so forth. But the generals did not want to invade Europe without testing that equipment and their methods. So they tried to persuade Churchill to have some sort of trial raid where they could test, but he didn't want to do that because the British people were so down that he felt, with the risk being so high that they would fail, that he should not let them do that. Eventually, the generals won, and in August 1942, a party of about 6,000, mainly Canadians, left Southampton Harbour for Dieppe. And their objective was to take the town, hold it for 24 hours, and then withdraw. Well, it was an absolute disaster. They found that the German defences were far stronger than they thought. Much of the equipment didn't work. The tanks got stuck in the sand. They never even arrived at the battle. on the bridge over the River Sai into Dieppe, the bodies of British and Canadian soldiers were so thick the soldiers trying to escape couldn't even get across it. And there was absolutely no chance that they were going to hold the town for 24 hours. They couldn't take it, and they had to withdraw under the most horrendous circumstances. So bad, in fact, that over half the men didn't return. Many of them were killed, and the others were taken into captivity. So the message that you would have got had you been British here at the time was really that this had been a terrible failure. And even the men who were leading the mission thought that it was a terrible failure, because, you see, there was something going on there that they didn't know about. They had among them a man by the name of Jack Nissenthal, who was a radar expert. And he was on a very secret mission that even the leaders of this raid didn't know about. And he was to get into the radar station above Dieppe on the cliffs and take some key equipment, bring it back to Britain, and they knew that that would tell them things about the German radar system that would be absolutely crucial in the invasion that was to come 2 years later. Well, Nissenthal, in fact, he was such an important character in the British setup that he had five bodyguards with him, and they were assigned to shoot him rather than let him fall into enemy hands. He didn't know that. Well, he never got anywhere near the radar station. The best he could do was get to the perimeter fence, which was quite far from the station itself, shin up a pole and cut a telephone wire. The Germans inside the radar station had now lost their contact with high command, so they used their radios. And those signals were picked up on the Sussex coast, not far from where I'm living now. When they analyzed those signals, they learnt everything they wanted to know about the German radar system. And so when it came time to invade 2 years later, they were able to jam the German radar system, which gave them complete control of the air. And as a result, that invasion, with the equipment working perfectly, the invasion went off without a hitch. So you see, whether that raid was a success or a failure depended on your point of view. It depended on what you knew about what was behind the events. And nobody on that raid, apart from Nissenthal, knew. The British people didn't know, but in actual fact, it was such a success that it was a turning point in the war. Paul Tournier, in a book I love called The Adventure of Living, which is where the name of our course came from, said it is extremely difficult to define failure and success. The line between them is so elusive. Today's failure may well turn out to be tomorrow's success, and today's success, tomorrow's failure. Isaiah 46:10, I am God, there is none other like me who can tell what is going to happen. So there we are. Only God knows, really, whether something is a success or failure very often. And in life, many times the most important things that happen to us, or the most important achievements or failures that we think we're having, only God knows what their value really is. All that I say will come to pass. Now, so it's complicated because you can't tell success from failure a lot of the time. It's also complicated because often you need failure in order to succeed. That's very well illustrated by this story. In the 1940s, early 1940s, there was a man named Tsuhira living in Japan. He was passionate about motorbikes and he wanted to build them. But he was poor and he didn't have much knowledge, so he decided to start small and make piston rings, hopefully for Toyota. Problem was, he couldn't figure out how to do it, so he spent all his money researching this thing on how to make piston rings. And when he finally learned through many trials and errors, he'd run out of money and couldn't build the tiny factory he needed, so he pawned his wife's jewelry, which bothered his family a bit, And he was able to build a very small factory and successfully started to supply Toyota. Well, his business grew quite quickly. And having now made a little bit of money, he could expand, so he built a much bigger factory to supply Toyota. And within months of building it, the Americans bombed it and flattened it completely. But Sahira was made of really stern stuff, so with great difficulty now, he set about rebuilding the factory. Problem was that he couldn't get cement because of the war. So again, through trial and error, he worked out how to make his own and ultimately was able to build his factory a second time. They'd only just moved into it when the Americans bombed it again and flattened it completely. How would you have felt? Sekira was, as I say, made of tough stuff, and he started building again. By now, the war ended, and he was able, in the first month after the war, to move into his third factory. And then disaster struck again. An earthquake destroyed his factory a third time. And again, he rebuilt. I mean, this guy was made of something else. Then he had a lucky break. He found some disused generators that the army had been using. He took the engines, he put them onto frames that he had built, and he sold his first motorbike. And within a fairly short time, he was able to sell his first, what became a famous Cub motorbike. And within 10 years, from 1952, his company became the world leader in motorbikes. I suppose you know that I'm talking about Sekira Honda. And the very interesting thing is that later in his life, he said this: success can be achieved only through repeated failure and introspection. In fact, success represents only 1% of your work, and it results from the 99% that is called failure. Now, this is not a Christian guy, this is a pagan. The world knows this. The world knows that success and failure is complicated. I think sometimes we as Christians get duped into believing that because we have faith that it's all going to be okay. There's some preachers who say those things. No, it's complicated. It's complicated because we don't know the end from the beginning, and because sometimes God wants to put us through hoops because we need it. When all kinds of difficulties crowd into your life, said the Apostle James, realize that they come to produce in you the quality of endurance, until endurance is fully developed, and you will find that you have become a mature character. So God may put us through the hoops. But you see, success is not purely cerebral, and it's not particularly simple. What it is profoundly spiritual, and that's what I learned. It's profoundly spiritual. And even though I was a Christian when I was chasing success, I'd lost the plot a bit, and I needed to be taught a lesson. And I started to get that lesson on the day that I was talking about. All right, now let's come back to our psalm. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in season, whose leaf also does not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. Now, I want you to notice a few things about this passage. There are three very, very colorful pairs of words, and they in here, and they are, in the Hebrew poetry, a descending progression. So, if you walk with somebody, it doesn't, you know, you're just going along, if you like. It doesn't mean necessarily that you want to be where they are going, but you're just going along with them. And the picture here is of somebody who just kind of goes with the crowd, okay? Goes with the ungodly, not willing to stand up for what's right. That's the first step downwards. The second step downwards, Second step downwards is stands. Now standing with sinners, kind of rooted to the spot, starting to listen to what they're saying, starting to be one of them. And then finally, sits in the seat of mockers. Become actively engaged in being ungodly. You might even get as far as Richard Dawkins saying that he's a militant atheist. And it's sometimes horrifying to listen to the way that he mocks people of faith. So there's a downward progression. And the psalmist is saying that's the extreme opposite of what the godly person is like. The godly person delights in the law of the Lord and meditates on it day and night. Now, the picture there is of somebody who's not just kind of, by the way, a Christian. It's somebody who is daily, day and night, their thoughts are about God. The concentration of their whole lives is about God. Now, look, we're not perfect. You know, if you knew me better, you'd know how imperfect I am. So we're still sinners. But there is an orientation of our lives towards God that is fixed. Our intention is to please Him. Our intention is to walk with Him. Our intention is to do His bidding. That's what this picture is about. And that's the kind of person who is like a tree planted by the rivers of water. Now, the picture there is not of a tree planted by a natural river. It's actually of a fruit tree planted in an orchard with irrigation canals on both sides of it, because remember, this was dry country, where it can put its roots down deep, where it's got a consistent supply of water, where it can spread its branches. Its leaves never get withered by the sun, and it brings forth its fruit in good season. That's the picture the psalmist had in mind. And it's that kind of person for whom this promise applies, that whatever he does will prosper. Well, actually, there the psalm is a little bit more complicated, because what I found was that the English translations vary. Some of them say, whatever he does shall prosper. Others of them say, he will prosper in whatever he does, or whatever he does will succeed. Even that word is used in some translations. So there can you get it? There are two separate pictures here, actually, depending on which translation you read. Some of them are saying the individual will prosper. So then that's kind of independent of what happens to his ventures, but that he will prosper, or she. The other picture is that what they do will prosper. So you've got two things. Which one is right? Well, actually, in the Hebrew, they're both there. And I think that's why you get these two different translations. They are actually both there, saying that the individual will prosper and what he does or she does will prosper. Now, you know, that is exactly the same picture, if you like, that Jesus gave when he was talking to his disciples. In John 15, he said, unless you abide in me, you can't do anything. But if you abide in me, then you will bear much fruit. Get the picture. So here we've got a person who's focused on God. He's first. I'd lost sight of that. He's deeply rooted. And he will prosper, she will prosper, and the ventures will prosper. But this is long-term stuff. We know that success and failure in the short term aren't the real deal. I learned that in my office, and you can see people learning that all the time. Watch people who get instant fame, success, and money. Watch how they become disillusioned. Watch how their lives go off the rails. It's almost a guarantee. If you get too much too soon, too young, the chances you become disillusioned or go off the rails are very, very high. I could reel off name after name along that line. So we know that this is not a short-term game. We're looking at a long-term game here. And what we all want is to get to the end of life and to be able to look back and say, wow, I'm really glad I lived that way. I have prospered and God has blessed me. God has used what I've done. I'm glad I did that. Now, that's the picture in Psalm 1. It's what I learned. And the question really is, how does that work on the ground? in everyday life? How does that work? That's what we want to know. And I want to share with you. So let's go back to the cycle and use it differently. You take an action, you get a result. It doesn't matter whether the result is success or failure, because what you do is you interpret that in the light of Scripture. Romans 8:28, everything works together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Or Psalm 37, the steps of good men and women are directed by the Lord. He delights in each step they take. If they fail, it isn't fatal, because the Lord holds them in His hand. Matthew, I will be with you always, says Jesus. The Holy Spirit is always with us, come success or failure. And the Apostle Peter, you can leave all your anxieties with Him because He cares for you. Paul Tournier says the value, the infinite value of biblical perspective is that it changes our attitude to the events of life. It's no longer a matter of whether they constitute success or failure, but rather what they mean in God's purpose. I think that's brilliant. Very well captured. Now, I thought I should tell you of an experience of mine that perhaps illustrates how this works on the ground. This address that I'm giving you today is based on one that comes from the Adventure of Living course by the same title, Things Aren't What They Seem. And what had happened was I had developed the course out of the experience that I gained, starting with the journey that I told you about. And as a result of God speaking very, very clearly to me, not only to my spirit, but through other people, to share what I'd learned with younger people. And so I created that course. And it was intended at that time to only be for the young people in my church, 20s and 30s. Well, I didn't realize what was going to happen, because it got into the hands of other people. And after a couple of years, some of them came to me and said, in fact, it was a fellow who was South African living in London, came to me and said, look, I want to take this course to London. I need you to give it all to me. And long story short, they said, you've got to put this on video. So I had then to arrange. I wasn't convinced, I must tell you. I really wasn't convinced. I didn't want to do it. But ultimately, they persuaded me. And so we got together one of the courses at our church. We arranged for a video crew to put it on video, and we started the thing. Now, you need to know that this was huge for me. I was not an accomplished speaker, and the idea of speaking to an audience in front of television cameras was terrifying. I mean, really terrifying. Well, we got through the first session all right, and then we came to the second one. And as I spoke to these people, about 50 or 60 of them, I started to feel that I didn't have a connection. I'm very sensitive to audience, by the way. If you're fidgety, I can see immediately. And I could see on their faces this sort of glazed look. And I thought, I'm not getting through to them here. I tried this and tried that, but it just didn't seem to work. And we came to the end of this session, really important one about risk and failure, fear of failure. And I felt I'd blown it. And I just didn't know what we were going to do, because, you know, it was costing a lot of money to do this. I didn't see how we could do it again. And I went home feeling awful, just awful. I didn't talk to anybody. I just went home, went to bed, and of course I couldn't sleep. Just didn't sleep a wink the entire night. Kept my wife awake. I mean it, not a single wink. Went to the kitchen, got milk and Marie biscuits, tried to calm myself down. Still couldn't sleep. And then as I was lying in bed, it was that same voice said to me, I've done this for a reason. I said, you have you? Well, I'm not enjoying it. But look, if I've got to go through this for the good of other people, fine, I'll accept it. And then the voice said, I want you to share this with them. And my instant reaction was, no, forget it, No way, I'm not sharing this with anybody. This is just too painful. I want you to share this with them. Well, it dawned on me then that the following session was this one, that I needed to talk to them about success and failure. And here I was feeling I'd been the most monumental failure. The most important thing that I had ever tackled was, in my view, now a complete disaster. And now I was supposed to tell them about it. It took me a long time to come to terms with it. I only had a week, but it took all of that. Eventually, when I got on my feet, I had decided that I would talk to them about it. And so at this point in the thing, I did, and I told them the story. Unfortunately, I was so overwhelmed by the whole thing that I became emotional and broke down. And so it was quite a struggle to finish the thing, tears streaming down my face and so forth. But the thing that saved it for me was that I could see on their faces this time an engagement that was amazing. Now they were listening. So I was saying, well, okay, Lord, maybe it's worth it. There was more. Because when I got the edit version back from the edit house, they'd included the breakdown. I said, you can't do that. Take that out. So they took it out. And then they came back to me and said, Roland, you can't do that. You've got to leave it in. You've got to leave it in. It took ages for me to come to agreement on that because I didn't want to be embarrassed like that. And so, you know, I talked to various people. I showed it to friends and so forth. And long story, it stayed in and they won. Now, I can't tell you how many people have come to me or written to me about that session and said how helpful it was to them. People who were in deep trouble, people who've had enormous failure, people who struggled with risk, struggled with ventures that they know God is prompting them to take. Many of them have come to me. I've just lost count of the number who've come to me and said, Roland, that session was amazing. Now, we don't always get the chance to see the results of the things we do. Sometimes, often, we don't. But I'm trying to say to you, you know, it does make sense. Even if you can't see where it's going, you can just interpret what's happening to you in the light of Scripture, those Scriptures that I've put up, and say, okay, God, you do it your way, and I'll just buy in. And just keep going. Just keep trusting God because you can depend on Him. He's not going to let you down. He doesn't make mistakes. And He will see to it that you prosper. Now, I wonder what you're thinking at this point. Maybe you've had some real failures of your own. Maybe there are ventures that you are trying or should try, and you're afraid of them. Don't need to be. Because you see, this whole thing changes our attitude, doesn't it? If you can internalize this, it changes your attitude, firstly, to the events of life, things that happen to you over which you have no control. Because you say, I know God's in control. I know I can trust Him. No matter what happens, I know I can trust Him. But it also changes your attitude to risk. It changes your attitude to tackling the things to which God calls you, even though you may feel that they're risky. And even though you may attempt them and feel you've failed, your attitude is different. And so it brings out of us the very best that we have. It makes use of all that God has given us in time and talents and training and personality. Can you see that? I'm going to finish with a story. But before I do, you go on from there. We're saying, you know, that negative feedback becomes positive feedback. And of course, the whole thing just goes on. The doubt becomes belief, not belief in me, which is the way the psychologists talk, but belief in God and trust in God. The hesitation turns to eagerness. And of course, that will lead to wholehearted action. And long-term success. I'm not saying everything works out well now. a long-term game this is. And you will prosper. We will prosper. So it's not purely cerebral. It's not particularly simple. It is profoundly spiritual. Now the story that I want to finish with. When J.R. Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings, he imagined an immense story, a mythology that was with a very complicated plot. And he knew that to make this thing real and to give it make it compelling, he needed to invent a number of imaginary languages and cultures and histories. And it took decades. He worked on it for decades. And then when he got to the most complicated part of the plot, he ran out, as he says, of mental energy and inventiveness and came to a complete standstill, writer's block, par excellence. And nothing happened, and he was depressed. He seriously doubted that he would ever finish the book. And he said it was just a terrifying, overwhelming, depressing thought. Then one day he woke to find that a beautiful tree near his home had been lopped and mutilated by a neighbor. And when he saw it, it made him think about his internal tree, his story, that he thought he would never finish. And he thought he might suffer the same fate as the tree. And that sparked a train of thought which led him to write a story for the Dublin Review called Leaf by Niggle. Niggle was a painter. Now, niggle means to fiddle, to work ineffectually, to concentrate on unimportant details. That was niggle. Well, niggle had a vision of a magnificent painting of a huge tree with a wonderful, beautiful country opening out behind it. And so large was his vision that he erected an enormous canvas, so big he needed a ladder. And he would paint away endlessly. Problem was, he couldn't prevent himself from fiddling. So he worked on one leaf, trying to get the shading just right and the dewdrops to capture it, to get it perfect. But very little ever showed up on the canvas. Problem was that Niggle had a long journey to make and he didn't want to go. It was actually death. And he thought to himself, well, I'll just finish this painting. He dropped everything else. I'll just finish this painting before I have to go. Well, it wasn't helped by the fact that he had a very kind heart and his neighbors kept asking him to do things for them, especially Parrish, who didn't like his paintings. And one day, Parrish came and said, late at night, come, please help me, my wife's sick. So out he went into the wet and cold to fetch a doctor for Parrish's wife. He caught a chill, and in the morning the driver came to take him on the journey. After his death, they found this huge canvas with one leaf on it, and they hung it in a forgotten corner of the town museum, seen by very few people, and they all forgot completely about Niggle. But that's not the end of the story. When Niggle got on the train to the heavenly country, as they arrived at the outskirts, something caught his eye. There was a huge tree, and he got off and ran to it, and there he saw this was his tree, finished in all its glory, its leaves green, its branches spreading, waving in the wind. And he realized this was not a figment of my imagination. Here it is, in the true reality, the reality behind the earthly existence that will last forever. And my tree is going to be here forever to be enjoyed. And he lifted his hands in the air and he said, it's a gift. It's a gift. Now, Tolkien was greatly encouraged and comforted by his own story because, of course, he was Niggle. He had exactly those characteristics and he knew it. He was a fiddler. And he was greatly comforted, and it helped him to come to terms with the possibility that he might never finish his book and that he might be seen in the eyes of the world as a failure. But it also helped him to write again. And it's bizarre, isn't it, that the book he then finished was such a masterpiece, so inspired that it became one of the best-selling books of all time. And of course, it's been made into very successful films as well. Now, can you relate to Niggle? You know, in a way, we're all niggle, aren't we? I mean, none of us wants to fail. We all want to succeed at life. We all have visions of making a difference, of counting, of being remembered for something. And many of us get to feel, hey, I don't know if I'm going to pull this off. I don't know where you are at the moment. I find many people don't even have a canvas yet. At least Nigel had erected a big canvas. I find many people have no canvas. There is no vision about what God would want to do with them. They're not following anything. They haven't discovered that. Well, if you're there, I want to say to you, look, you got work to do. That's what the Adventure of Living Course is for, and I'm not pumping it. I'm just saying you've got work to do. There are lots of ways to do it, but you need to discover what is it that God is calling you to that will use everything you've got, your talents, your personality, your training, your abilities, that He could inspire to do something amazing with that you can't even imagine. You need a canvas. Maybe you've got the canvas, but you've got writer's block. You're stuck. You could be stuck for a whole lot of reasons. Maybe you've experienced some failures or rejection. Maybe you can't see what to do next. There could be a million reasons that you might not even be giving it your all. Maybe you've given up a bit and you should get back on the job. But whatever it is, what I'm trying to say to you through this story is there is a tree. There is a tree. Your tree, the tree that God has called you to paint. And what you've got to do is keep showing up for the job so that He can invest Himself in your work and that ultimately it'll be to His glory in a way you can't even imagine. I hope that this little study of Psalm 1 and success and failure is a help to you. And if I can help you afterwards at all, please talk to me. Thank you.